Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, they don't get any bigger than this, the Hall of Famer, an author, also a unbelievably successful pop songwriter as well, from the band The Go-Go's, Gina Schock is here. And self-proclaimed punk. We'll get that all down in a second. But first, if you'd like to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is from my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan. I love you, buddy. Thank you for all your hard work. Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Left4Damian. Tristan also runs a Instagram for the show, which is at Turned Out of Punk, and there's a Facebook for the show, Turned Out of Punk on Facebook, and I think that is about it for social media platforms for this thing. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is by telling all of your friends about it, letting everyone know that you know that we do this podcast each and every week. You can also support this podcast by going to turnedoutofpunk.com and getting a t-shirt. And thank you to everyone that already has picked up one of those shirts. Very much appreciate it. And thank you to Corey for all his hard work setting that thing up for me. And more stuff coming. We got a lot more stuff coming out of that soon. You can also support the show by heading over to patreon.com/turnedoutofpunk and checking some of the stuff that we do over there. There's video versions of some of the episodes of the show. There's footnotes. There's all sorts of stuff. Preview episodes, lost episodes, things like that. So check out that. And thank you to everyone that does do that. It is very much appreciated. And while I'm on the topic of thanks, this thing would not be possible without the kind support of the fine folks at Vans, who came aboard a few years ago and said, Damian, do your thing. Just don't do it out of your own pocket. And they helped me cover the cost of this thing, which is very much appreciated because there are costs with doing a free podcast. Go figure. So thank you to them for their support. All right. Oh, no. And I also play in a band. I play in a band called Fucked Up. We're going to be, I don't know. I don't know what's going to be happening in a few weeks, but potentially we'll be going on tour and these shows are selling out. So please go and pick up a ticket while you can for some of these shows because, you know, I'll be able to get some people in on the guest list, but not everyone. Oh. All right. I'm now joined by my littlest ray of sunshine, Camden. Cam, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Okay, Cam's going to be joining us here, so I'll keep this next part brief. I also play in this band called Effed Up. We have some records that are going to be being reissued on Matador Records, which the other shoe is on. It's on yes. David Comes to Life, which is out now. Also, Epics and Minutes, which is our first singles compilation, is going to be coming out on the incredible Get Better Records. They've also just announced they've got a tape collect club. Situation that we're going to be part of as well with a reissue of Epics and Minutes on cassette. So hopefully that thing is not sold out by the time you hear this. If you do want that cassette, if you are a fan of cassettes, I know I've got some friends that do not like tapes. Cam, you don't care about any of these physical formats at all, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like nothing. But anyway, on to today's show. Oh, yeah, we might be going on tour too. So check out our tour dates over at fuckedup.cc. I know, I shouldn't swear. I know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Cam looked at me.
You said the F word.
I did say it there. I'm sorry. All right, on to today's show. Today on the show, from a band that pretty much everyone in the family listens to, because Lauren and I both love them very much, The Go-Go's. Gina Schock is on the show today. She has also written songs for a lot of pop stars, too, that you like. Like a lot of Miley Cyrus and stuff like that. And I think she's Selena Gomez and stuff. So she's done.
No, I don't know. Okay, I don't know.
You don't like those artists? But you know those artists, right? You know their song? Yeah, you know their song. You and your brothers know their songs. They listen to pop radio a lot too. So she's written a lot of incredible pop songs. Well, Go-Go songs too. I love some of her Go-Go songs. And then House of Schock. Okay, I'm sorry, Kim. I'm sorry. Keep
no,
him free.
I'm just saying this noise.
Okay, We'll move on. Anyway, Gina is also a legit Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, inducted this year. Congratulations to the Go-Go's. Well-deserved. Very, very awesome. Adds more, a little more legitimacy to that building, as far as I'm concerned, now that they're there. And I'm honored to have her on the show. We also had Jane on the show from the Go-Go's and Kathy from the Go-Go's on the show this year. So it's been a real Hall of Famer year for us in the Go-Go's here at Turned Out of Punk. Gina has written an incredible new book called Made in Hollywood, All Access to the Go-Go's, with the Go-Go's, to the Go-Go's. Let me, if you look up Gina Schock, Go-Go's, All Access, Made in Hollywood, All Access with the Go-Go's. It's out now. This book's a monster. It weighs like 3 pounds, but this thing looks incredible. It's on my my wish list this year for the holidays. Shout out to John Worcester for throwing me a couple questions for this as well, because I know he's a huge fan. And that's it. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the great, the Hall of Famer, Gina Schock on Turned Out a Punk. Gina, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I'm glad that I'm around and could be around to talk to you.
Well, as we were just talking about off air, to me, you know, the Go-Go's are the first punk supergroup. Like, you really do have, you know, yourself coming from Baltimore, Kathy coming from Texas, members of the Eyes, members of the Textones. You have like one of the first sort of comings together of people that are representing the first waves of punk hitting, and then coming together to ultimately create one of the biggest punk bands of all time in the Go-Go's.
This is, you know what? It's absolutely true. We are, our roots are punk. That's what we were, a punk band. We are a punk band at heart. When we play live, I think it's very obvious. We're rough around the edges and we just rock, you know? We do what we do. We're not great musicians, and thank God, because that's the sound of this band. That's the, you know what I mean? That's what makes up the Go-Go's. We weren't all these, you know, child prodigies that were like, oh, we could play our instruments when we were 3 years old. None of that crap. You know, the girls, Jane and Belinda, they just started playing when the band got together. They just picked up their instruments. And Charlotte, too, she was a piano player. She played piano and she played bass with the Eyes. But she switched over onto guitar and it's all worked out. And then Kathy, of course, had been playing guitar in many other bands. And I had been playing drums in other bands in Baltimore. But then when I came out to L.A., I was just hungry to find a band. And when I met the girls at a party, it all came together. It was like, okay, I got this, come over to my friend's house. We're going to try out some songs. They wanted to get rid of their drummer. I was looking for a gig with a band that I really felt like I fit in with. And when my friend that I was living with, Steve, took me to see them when I first got to LA in 79, he was like, you got to see this band, the Go-Go's. You need to get in there, kick the drummer out, and then you're going to make them really famous. And I went to see them, and they were having such a blast on stage. And, you know, man, I needed that desperately because I was way too serious about playing. Then we just started rehearsing a lot more. Well, first of all, when I first came to L.A., it was in 1978, and I came out there with a punk band, Edith Massey from John Waters Films, E and the Eggs. And that's when I met the three people that I knew in L.A. And that was my friend Rilla, whose house I'm at right now, and my friend Steve Martin and Doug Martin, these two redheaded twins, these two redheaded crazy brothers. And they were producing the Edie and the Egg show at the Newark Theater here in L.A. And we did like three shows in one night. And I became friends with Steve, Doug, and Rilla. And when I went back to Baltimore after doing that crazy tour with Edie, I had decided that I wanted to, it was time to leave. You know, I was 21 going on 22, and this was my moment to like really either, you know, I had to make a decision, and I felt like this was the perfect opportunity for me. I knew a couple people in LA, I knew a couple people in San Francisco, and I knew a couple people in New York City. But I took like, in 6 months after I got back, I went to LA for a little bit. I went to San Francisco. I went up to New York, got back, and really decided that LA, I could afford to live there. The cost of living was something that I could handle. San Francisco was too expensive and New York was too expensive. Mm. And it was too hard. Those cities were just difficult. And LA was just sunshine. And I don't know, the community was wide open. The punk community was, everybody, it was inclusive, you know? I went home, packed everything up in my dad's pickup truck and drove across country with everything. Got to my friend Steve's house. He let me set up my PA because back then you had to have your own PA when you played. So I got my PA, my drums, all my vinyl, everything I owned in that pickup truck. And a friend of mine from high school, we drove across country. When we got to LA, I moved right in with Steve. Babs and I moved in with Steve. And that's when he started taking me around to look at bands. And when I got there, I put my name up in like all the record stores and music stores and my influences. I was looking to join a band. And then that's when Steve said, there's this band called the Go-Go's. I want you to see them. So we went to Club 88 and I saw them play. And that's when I was like, I want to be in this band. They are having so much fun. And they're kind of rough. They weren't that great. They weren't the best musicians, but they were having a lot of fun. Mm. And I thought if I could just get in there and get them on a schedule, I know there's something there. There's something, you know, there's diamonds in the rough. There's something there that is special. And, you know, I just felt like I needed to be a part of it. So when I met them at Steve's brother's house, Doug's house, at a party he was having, it was Belinda, Jane, and I think Margo. And so we set up a date and time to go to Steve's house, and we played a couple songs, and boom, that was it. They fired their drummer the next day, and I quit the two bands that I was in, and that's how the Go-Go's really started in earnest.
Well, it's incredible, too, because, like, you're all unbelievable songwriters. You know, like, it's amazingly rare to have that with a band where everyone can write songs.
Yeah, it's, Jane and Charlotte, they were great right off the bat. Kathy came in and she was really good. And Belinda, you know, would put her 2 cents in all the time, you know. And then I started to write as the records went on. And then I got better and better and better until I, you know, get songs with other artists, which was wonderful. That took many years, but, you know, it's hard to get your song covered by Miley Cyrus or Selena Gomez. It's not easy. Yeah. Anyway, the bottom line with all that is that the truth of this is, Damien, is that if it wasn't the five of us together putting our 2 cents into these songs, the songs wouldn't matter. Mm-hmm. Nothing would matter. It had to be the chemistry, the five of us. What we each put into every song is what makes it what it is. It's what made them into hit songs. If there was an element missing, who knows what would have happened? I just know that it's a 50-50 thing. You gotta have great songs, and you gotta have the platform to sell it. You know, you can write songs till the day you die, and if you don't have a way to sell them, doesn't matter. So one half needs the other. I write about that in my book. And I think, like I said, I just think one is no good without the other. And, you know, certainly a band like ours, the five of us are what people come to see. There's not just one of us in the band that everybody, you know, that's all they care about. You know, everybody has their fan base in the band. You know, there's people that love Kathy Moore or Belinda Moore or Jane or me or Charlotte. It's a very cool thing. Well, that's because I think there are five beauties in this band.
Absolutely. Well, and also five, you know, because I think, you know, not to undersell that chemistry that you have when you're together, but all of you have done great solo stuff, you know, like House of Shocks, like the stuff you did, those records are incredible. The songwriting there is awesome.
You know, everybody, I'll tell you the truth. I had no intention and never wanted to be, do solo records, but that's why I found a partner. I found in Vance DeGeneres. I don't like being on my own, and I'm no good on my own. I got to have somebody to bounce ideas off of. I got to have that person, you know, and I found Vance, and I knew we had something. We started writing and it made sense. We got along great. Our personalities were good together. And then we found the rest of the players for the band. And we did one show. Miles Copeland was managers. We did one show at the Roxy, and we got a record deal on Capitol, which was pretty phenomenal, I think. So everything just, and everybody, everything came together for everybody. Everybody has their own groove, but the most important groove is the Go-Go's, as far as I'm concerned. It always will be.
Did you know Vance from The Cold? Like, did the Go-Go's ever play with The
Cold?
No, I
didn't
know
The Cold. No, he was New Orleans fellow, and he came to LA, and his sister was coming out here doing comedy clubs at the time. And I forget how I met Vance, actually. I don't recall, probably through a friend of a friend, because I was really looking hard to find somebody to start a band with, because I knew I couldn't be a session drummer. That's just not in my DNA. It's not who I am. When I met him and we started hanging out, I thought, yeah, man, this is going to work. And then when we started writing, it was easy. It was very easy. And Vance was a really good player, you know?
Yeah. And I love the Colts. The songs that the Cold had were awesome. They're a really underrated power pop group, I think.
Absolutely. See, you know, I feel like, and also, you know what? I truly believe that at the bottom of every, at the core of every punk band, there's a pop melody.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Yep. I just think it's hidden in there. You can't always see it, but mm-hmm. if you listen, like I can tell,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I look at Green Day. They have the best fucking pop melodies in the world, you know, and they're a punk band.
Yeah. Or like the Go-Go's, X, like even the Germs.
Oh, well,
like,
of course, the obvious, you're stating the obvious, but yeah, all of our songs were, we were a punk band, and Richard, our producer, just came in and, slowed everything down. That's what made the difference. He wanted to make us appeal to a larger audience, you know? And at the time that when he did it, we hated it. We thought he wrecked our fucking band. We thought our careers were over. This doesn't sound like us. But, you know, when it went to number one, we're like, oh, Richard, you're brilliant. We love you, you know? But he knew the formula, man. That guy had written so many hit songs. He knew what he had to do to make us appeal to a large group of people. A larger group.
I do think there's like a great punk record that could have been done between the first single and Beauty and the Beat. Like there's like a really cool kind of like legendary punk record that would have come out. If like those demos from that time are incredible.
Well, you know what? Interestingly enough, we are digging deep. And when we do these shows in December, mm-hmm. we're digging deep in the catalog. And we're going to try to do like four or five really old songs that are, and they're punk. They're bam, bam, bam. You know, they are going to explode.
Awesome.
So when we get to rehearsal, we're going to work one. I think it's four or five of them. And, you know, we have been talking for ages about recording them because, I mean, it's because they're great. They're fun. It's who we are. That's interesting. It's so funny that you should say that because we're focusing on that right now.
Well, it's because I think it's, you know, not to undersell, you know, this classic album, which is, of course, celebrated. But I think there's also like, as you're saying, there's this melody that's in punk rock and there's all these great melodic punk songs like the Screamers, like there's hooks in all this stuff, you know.
Remember the Weirdos? Oh, my God. They were so fabulous.
Amazing.
That's a band that I don't understand why they were not hugely successful.
That seems to be the band that people from, like, you know, obviously your scene that are coming on this show seem to keep bringing up as being the band that should have. But I guess it's label?
Huh?
I guess it's being on shitty, like, they're not shitty labels, but being on the wrong label at every turn.
You know what? All I know is that timing is a crazy fucking thing, but it means everything.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way to gauge, you know, when you should be doing something. You do it when it's right. You get it together when it's right and you show it to people, you start performing or whatever platform you want to use to get your songs out there, to get your band out there. You do it when you're ready to do it. And hopefully the timing is right. But you never know. Like if the Go-Go's had come out now, it probably would never have happened. If it would have come out, if we'd have done things a year later, who knows? But timing, it's luck and timing and hard work, all those things together that makes something successful. I don't know. It's like the magic bullet. Nobody knows where it's going or where it's coming from. It's weird.
Well, or just like what would have happened if you guys hadn't put out that record because, you know, people talk about the Velvet Underground and how everyone who heard that first Velvet record went out and started a band. But I think the Go-Go's are the band, you know, through the Saturday Night Live appearance and just through kind of the status that you reached, gave so many people permission to play music, like just was like, you know, go do this.
I certainly hope so, because our story is anyone's story. And mine and Kathy's in particular, leaving our comfort zone, our home in another state, and driving to LA to make it. and then, you know, working hard, our due diligence, and then it absolutely happening in a major way. If we could do that, I just feel like anything is possible if you really want it bad enough and you're focused, and, you know, but you gotta be laser focused on something, and that you got to love it. It has to be something visceral, something that's just coming from your insides and exploding. I mean, I'm talking to you, I get all excited because I get excited about music. I love what I do. And I love this band that I'm in. And, you know, I love everything that has to do with music. When I was writing this book, that made me appreciate everything all the more because I was reliving, you know, every year of the Go-Go's, and especially focusing. Made in Hollywood focuses mainly on the earlier, from, you know, from like 79 to like 85. That's where it's mainly focused. And reliving all that just energized me in a way that I haven't felt in years and years, because I've relived it all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I open that book and I look at it, I just feel like, oh my God, this is my life. You know, I cannot believe what's happened to me. And then this Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing, you know, the icing on the cake, it was like, wow, God, you know, it's been a magical journey here. I don't know. It's crazy.
Well, you saw the I guess famously now, Led Zeppelin and The Who, right?
Oh, yeah.
My first show.
My first show. I was 11 years old. My brother took me. He had to babysit me, so he took me. And, you know, being 11 years old and having that be your first show, it blew my mind. I didn't know what to think. I didn't know. All I knew when I left that arena that day was, I got to get on that stage. Somehow I have to be on that stage one day. And you know, want to hear something crazy? I saw that first show at Meriwether Post Pavilion. And like 12 years later, I was playing on that very same stage. That's fucking nuts.
That's amazing.
So incredible, right?
Yeah. No, I think Baltimore, like, it's really early into, it's like obviously pre-punk, but like with bands like OHO and that band Split, like George Brigman, I think his name is.
I don't know.
Like he did a record called Jungle Rot in 74. Like, it feels like there was like a, and also of course, John Waters, there's like,
well,
an energy.
You know that, like, before, do you have my book? You need to have my book so you can look at
it. I know I'm getting it from my wife for Christmas, so I have not purchased it.
You know, if you have it, you're going to die. You're going to, oh God, you're going to go crazy. You're going to love it so much.
I can't wait.
There's a band in the book I put, you know, it's the genesis of my music career, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you'll see there's a band. We were Baltimore's first new wave punk band. We were called Scratch and Sniff.
Yes.
And we would do 4 sets a night, and we do 2 sets of originals and 2 sets of covers. But our covers were like Brian Eno and Roxy Music and weird shit that was like, wasn't the norm. And, you know, and the Ramones, and the Violators, you name it. We were doing a lot. And I was especially influenced by punk, UK punk, you know, movement was major in my education, punk education, or my music education, period. So we were really an interesting, great band, and we were managed by a woman named Christine Mason, who did all the hairdos in John Waters films.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
It's all in the family, you know?
That is amazing. Mm-hmm. So I guess at that time, where was the first time you heard of punk? Like, when do you remember coming across the word for the first time, or the genre?
I would get that magazine Punk.
Okay.
Do you remember that magazine Punk?
Yeah, the New York.
I still have that. I still have that tucked away somewhere. Because you know what? I save everything. That's what another thing, babe, is what my book is about. It's everything I've been saving my entire life is in that book. All my personal shit is in the book. It's like a love letter from me to somebody like you. And, you know, anybody else that loves this band, it is, it's very personal. Anyway, I'm sorry. I keep going back to the book because it's my life. Anyway, where were we? I got all fucking. Well,
no. I think we're talking about we're talking about your life, right? We're talking about, you know, in the book, kind of the fact that you're showing us this sort of punk band Scratch and Sniff.
So, you know, the bands that were that I was listening to were mostly UK punk bands, as I said. The Damned, the Violators. Who else? Well, of course, the Sex Pistols.
Buzzcocks. What have they been? Were they a little bit later?
Oh, talk about great pop songs, Buzzcocks. Yeah. You better believe it. Yeah.
So yeah. Was that John Waters? I guess it's like kind of that culture loomed large over the city or over the arts community within.
Yeah, absolutely. John was the king in Baltimore. He still is, really. And I started hanging out downtown with that crowd, his crowd kind of, and meeting Edie, the egg lady, who she had a thrift store on Broadway. And when I moved out of my house, I was 20 or 21 when I moved out, I moved into Fells Point, which was like the hip area of Baltimore, right on the waterfront. And Edie had her shop, Edith's Shopping Bag. And she'd just be sitting there every day by the cash register, her and her cat, Lovey. And you'd walk in, she'd go, oh, hello, Gina, how are you? I'm going to put together a punk band. You want to be in it? I was like, yes, Edie. That's how Edie and the Eggs happened.
So was she going to shows or she just heard that punk was this thing that was kind of happening and figured
she just knew from being around everybody that was in the, you know, all the hipsters were hanging out with John and the whole crew. They were all the hipsters, you know, from downtown and Fells Point. And people, you know, all the people in John's films were just like friends of his. They weren't actors. Nobody was an actor. It was just a crazy group of people hanging out at the time. And, you know, his films are not far from the truth of the way people live in Baltimore. It's like crazy. People, I would bring friends to my house in my neighborhood in Baltimore years ago. And they were like, Gina, you need to document all this. This is unbelievable. I can't believe people are fucking crazy here. And it's, I don't know if it's the water or whatever it is, but Baltimore is, it's a very eccentric city. People are a little off.
Yeah. No, I've never thought.
In the best possible way.
You know, I've never thought of it till you said that, but you're right. Like the arts community that comes out of the art that comes out of there is always a little like left of even center. It's like always out there.
There's so many weird little quirks about that city, like the marble steps and everybody in Holland, we could call it Holland Town, but it's Highland Town. It's spelled Highland Town, but it's Holland Town. And in Holland Town, all the German and Polish ladies, all with the marble steps and the row homes, all have screens that are painted. They're painted like scenery, country scenery, trees and grass. Like, I thought that was normal, but no, I've never seen that anyplace else.
No, that's really weird. That, I guess it is like, it is a very colorful arts community too.
Colorful is the, you know what? You just chose all capital letters when you say colorful. That is Baltimore.
Yeah.
And that certainly was the scene years ago because it was sort of unbridled. It was out of control and great.
Well, like, and I think even like bands like Half Japanese or like the stuff that's coming out of there a little bit later, it's even that stuff is a little more esoteric and a little bit weirder than the stuff that's coming.
See, I'm
out
not
others.
Familiar with them, but I'm sure that I would probably like them.
Oh, you dig them. They're interesting. And they're like, I guess that's just after you leave. That's when I guess the scene sort of pops up a little bit more, you know, like I think you know, which is amazing. It's very similar to what Kathy was like in Texas, where she leaves Texas just before that scene kind of explodes.
Yeah.
You know, like you, both of you are sort of foundational in these scenes. Like what's that? The Marble Bar, right? Like that's where
Scratch and Sniff played. That's where we would play. And that was the hippest. And it's in the book. You'll read about our show at the Marble Bar.
Okay.
Cause that was the hippest place to play. And it was downtown. Like bands that would come into town that were cool, like Talking Heads or Ramones, they would play at the Marble Bar. It was in fact, the only place to play in the city there.
Okay.
And it had a really cool art scene. Everybody from the Institute of Art went there. And, you know, it was a great scene. Everybody was friends. And so when we were ready to play there, after we had done other shows, we did do our show at the Marble Bar. And the photos in the book are all taken at the Marble Bar.
So for those songs that was it Evidence? Was that the name of the band with you and Edith? Or was it the Egg Ladies with Edith?
No, it was Edie and the Eggs.
Oh, Edie and the Eggs. Okay, because were you writing the songs that would wind up on
No, I don't know who wrote those songs. All I know, she was just singing "Punks Get Off the Grass," and you know, and the songs that we put together, myself and two other girls, I don't can't remember anything about them because they were just not. They were just slapped together. They didn't not mention, not even worth mentioning. They were just not that great.
Were you playing with other bands? Like when you would go and do shows, was it booked because it's like the woman from the John Waters films, or is it like, no, were you playing with other punk bands?
Well, when I was growing up, I would try to get into bands, neighborhood bands and stuff. When you play like CYO dances and, mm-hmm. you know, I went to 12 years of Catholic school, you know, so we would play those sort of things. And I remember being in a band and it was all guys and they were, I don't even remember the name of the band. They were way older than me, but you know, they liked the fact that I was a girl and I played drums and I could keep up with the big boys kind of. And they would sneak me in if we were playing a bar or something, I'd have to come in the back way. But that was very short lived because, you know, I was constantly in search of a band that I really connected with. And I wasn't into a band that wanted to play covers, you know, yeah. I wanted to do original material, and the guys in Scratch and Sniff, they were about that. So that was a perfect fit for me. And while I was in that band, Edie came to me and offered me to be in the band. And I was like, yeah, of course I'm going to do that. That's my opportunity to get the hell out of Baltimore and see if I can actually make some connections like in LA and San Francisco and New York.
Well, yeah, because when you're playing these shows, when you're touring, are you playing with like local bands in New York and San Francisco and LA?
I don't remember us playing with anybody, but I can tell you we played Max's Kansas City and CBGB's. So that, can you imagine? I'm coming from Baltimore. The biggest thing I've ever done is the Marble Bar. And then I get up to New York. I'm at Max's. I mean, CBGB's. These are places that I was only reading about in Cream magazine or Rolling Stone,
yeah.
you know, or Punk.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure like, her coming there, I'm sure members of the Ramones were there, right? Like you're probably seeing these people.
I have no recollection who was there, but I'm sure because that, you know, I'm sure Debbie Harry was there. I'm sure a lot of people were there.
Yeah.
But I have no recollection.
So you mentioned, I heard you mention before that you were thinking of moving to other cities, you know, yeah. And I think even now you said you're thinking about moving to other cities. What was it about like going to LA and you said the punks were more welcoming there and it felt like a much
it
more
was like, I just remember, and I forget who told me this recently, that the scene it was Lisa Robinson. I did in conversation with Lisa Robinson, like that iconic rock journalist.
Yeah, absolutely.
In New York City, I just did a book signing there at Rizzoli and we were talking and she said, talking about that I went to LA, you know, because it cost a living. I could afford it. New York was too expensive. San Francisco was too expensive. But she also brought to my attention, she said, you know, the scene in New York was like, everybody was everybody's rival. Nobody, you know, everybody wanted to outdo each other. Mm-hmm. There was no camaraderie. It was like, you know, somebody's going to make it to the top of the heap and it's going to be us mentality. In LA, it was nothing like that. In LA, everybody was supporting each other. I mean, you could go and see three shows a night and it would be a group of us, a gang of us that would go from one club to the next. And then we get more people. Then they get done playing whatever band it was, you know, the Bags, whoever, whatever it was. And then we'd run to another club and see another band. It was a small group, but everybody was incredibly supportive. It was a very inclusive punk scene. And the mask was at the center of it all.
Yeah.
Where we all rehearsed, hung out, got loaded, and you name it.
I broke into that building a couple of years ago on a film production. So we could go down to the basement. Yeah, it's now, I think, actually, RuPaul's production company at the time was just above it.
And right in front, we got our star on Hollywood Boulevard directly in front of it.
I think it was just before you got your star.
Pussycat Club. Yeah. And we have our star right in front of that building.
It's amazing because the graffiti's still there. Like they've got all the shelving in front of it. Yeah.
They realized what they had, a real piece of history, mm-hmm. you know, is right in the downstairs of that building. Mm-hmm. So many bands came out of there. The one that really made it first was the Motels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they were the band that got like I think they got a deal on Warner Brothers or something. And we were like, wow, the Motels got a deal. Yay. You know, we were just happy for everybody.
And I guess like ultimately it gets signed as well. And
got signed to Slash Records, which is, you know, and that's another band. It's like the Weirdos and X. I don't know why they weren't huge. Yeah. X should have been way bigger, should be way bigger. I mean, I know that, you know, a lot of people know John and Xene now. And, you know, that band, is phenomenal. I mean, we would just, the girls in the Go-Go's, we would just stand on the side of the stage with our mouths hanging open watching them play, because it was something to see, man. The energy, the songs, everything that was going on that stage was incredible. What a band. What a band.
You didn't know John at all when he was in Baltimore, did you? Before he moved
out? No. Interestingly enough, yeah. I mean, we would talk about, John, you're from Baltimore. And I'm like, yeah, I'm from Baltimore. It was weird. I didn't know him.
Well, yeah, he must have moved out just before. Like, it must have been like ships crossing in the night
type
thing.
Yeah. We just missed each other, I think.
Yeah, and I guess the Dickies would also get signed to a major label. But it's really like the Go-Go's, like yourselves going in, and of course the Foo Fighters with Pat going in. It's really
Well, the Germs, and then of course the Dickies. Charlotte, our guitar player in the Go-Go's, she used to go out with Leonard.
Oh,
so we would go to all the Dickie shows, of course.
Yeah,
and that Charlotte and him were boyfriend and girlfriend, and then Charlotte was another boyfriend she had was Peter Case from the Plimsolls. They
the
got
Nerves.
A record deal. Yeah,
and the Nerves as well. Yeah,
like I said, we were all friends. Everybody knew each other.
Yeah, but I think it's like it's amazing how the history of rock and roll is changed by all these people in the basement of this building in Hollywood. You know, like
I know, it's just incredible. Mm-hmm. You know, Black Flag. There were just so many bands in and out of that place. And like I said, everyone knew each other. And the air of camaraderie was just prevalent. You know, it was everywhere. We were all friends and very supportive.
It's almost become kind of like a refrain on this podcast that, you know, this inclusive scene that you talked about coming to in LA changes when hardcore comes and sort of post Black Flag and post a lot of the beach scene. That, you know, there's a shift, you know, and it was a little less welcoming to some people, or some people have said that. And I just was wondering what your thoughts were. Did you notice a shift at any point in the scene?
You know what? I don't really know, because the truth of it is we were taken off by that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was completely immersed in it was everything Go-Go's. It was we lived, we breathed Go-Go's. That was it. That's all
mm-hmm.
we did.
Mm-hmm.
We were traveling constantly or making a record, but we were never in LA much, I'll tell you.
Go on.
No, I was going to say, you just reminded me of that band Fear and Lee. Lee was so great. We loved Fear. Those guys were fantastic. And Lee was such a badass. So funny. He was such a sweetheart to us. And he looked so mean. He was really mean and fierce and menacing, you know, but he was mm-hmm. a really sweet guy. Oh God, the Alley Cats. What about them? Wow. Oh, they were fantastic.
Incredible.
Now you're jogging my memory. I'm thinking of all the bands. Oh man.
It's
fantastic stuff.
Well, it's only like it's amazing when you kind of like break it down. It's such an explosion of sort of youth culture, you know, and it's.
Oh, absolutely.
And it feels like it's the first time that really kind of happens, because, you know, you could put out your own tapes. You could put out your own fanzine. You could put out your own record. Like, it was.
And, you know, sky was the limit. Anything you dreamed you could do. It was mm-hmm. weird. You just had to put it in motion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and get a couple friends together, make it happen. It, like I said, it felt like anything you dreamed could actually happen. It was weird, time, but a weird and wonderful time, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, and it definitely, people have talked about how Los Angeles, especially because you did have this huge sort of depth of studios and gear at your disposal.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You could find
music that, you know, I was so lucky to get there when I did, and how everything worked out for this band, because the punk scene was thriving. The music scene in general was thriving in the late 70s and the early 80s. Was any night of the week, you could go see a fantastic band play,
mm-hmm.
you know, any night of the week. And there were so many venues to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember hearing, like, in the 90s when everything really changed, and you had to actually pay to play in a venue.
Yeah.
How fucked is that?
Yeah.
Like, if you want to do a show somewhere, you'd have to actually pay to get a slot to be able to play that night. I thought, wow, this is all backwards. Something's wrong here. I'm glad we happened when we did, when it was like clean and beautiful. And, you know, it was just about the music. It wasn't money, money, money. It was about people wanting to get together and support something that they loved, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. And it feels like there's like an inverse reaction, in the sense that, you know, the scene kind of dries up. Like, you have the glam stuff, obviously, that pops off. But
yeah.
A lot of people talk about how L.A., because of the violence and because of the fact that it was pay to play.
Yep.
You didn't have a lot of young bands starting, and you didn't have a lot of that stuff downtown.
No. I don't know what. came out of LA, you know, I mean, well, everything changed. Mm-hmm. And I think like when rap came in, this whole scene changed, mm-hmm. which, you know, there's room for everybody, man. You know?
Yeah. I guess going back to like, you know, when it's kind of popping off and exploding, you know, one thing that was happening at that time, it certainly is like, you know, sort of like external violence being put on the punks, you know, like there's that famous St. Patrick's Day massacre show and the Go-Go's and X played.
Yep.
And you know, like, I was just wondering what your memories of that show were and just kind of in general, like the
actually
presence.
I was there and I just remember Steve grabbing me by my collar and pulling me the hell out of there and said, let's get the hell out of here now. Cause the cops, you know, it was out of control scene. I just got pulled out of there really quickly. Steve, thank God he was taking care of me and watching over me. You know, I was just this new kid in town. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was experiencing all this for the first time in LA. My eyes were wide open. I was just, I could have stood there all night and watched everything, probably get hit in the head with a fucking club or something. But I, you know, Steve pulled me out right quick when it all started going down.
Mm-hmm. And it feels like, you know, that kind of militarizes the scene in a certain way. And like, it's only natural that kids would eventually start, you know, like that violence would become internalized by, you know, like it's natural.
Yeah. I get it. But you know, the cops back then, it was a little out of control, you know, sort of they ruled, they could do whatever they wanted, you know? Mm-hmm. So you had to be really careful.
Another thing that kind of sweeps LA music at a certain point is rockabilly, you know, obviously the Blasters and things like that. And
the there's Blasters.
And there's that famous, I guess, Levi and the Rock Cats.
See, look, both of those bands, like Belinda was going out with Buster in the Blasters. Jane was going out with Levi. I mean, or one of the guys in the band. It was always, we were always going out with other people in other bands.
Well, that's the thing about the Go-Go's. It's like, you're never caught up in any of these sort of like fashion trends within punk. Like you're like, it's just like about the music above all else.
Well, you know, but you know what? Our fashion trend was whatever we could find at the thrift store.
Yeah.
We didn't have any money. I mean, I remember I would eat at Taco Bell every single day and I would get a taco with no meat. I just get, you know, a vegetarian, like several vegetarian tacos. I remember eating that a lot. And then when I worked at a store in Beverly Glen, when I lived at Steve's house and I worked at a grocery store up the street, a guy that was the butcher there, he would cut like good, like filet mignon and T-bone steaks and shit and put them in a plastic bag with ice cubes and throw it in the trash. And then after work, I'd go and fish that out of the trash can and take it home and we'd cook that up. I mean, we were poor. Yeah. We were poor, babe. We didn't have money. Mm-hmm. So, you know, anything was, I mean, what was that fella's name? God, I wish I could remember his name. He was good to me. He was always throwing something in that trash for me to pick out every day. Oh my God.
I guess that also is, you know, that's what the music's kind of bore out of too, is like the sort of scrappiness, like, you know, it's not because you're like workshop shopping it for years, like an Emerson, Lake and Palmer prog rock thing. It's very immediate. It has to happen now with the Go-Go's.
It felt like it did. There was an immediacy about, is that a word? An immediacy?
An immediacy. Yeah, definitely. Immediacy is a word.
It's a tongue twister, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. About what we were doing. It had to happen now, right now. Yeah. It had to happen now. And the music, it felt that way. The music spoke in that way. So yeah, you're right about that.
You end up going to the UK pretty early on, but you're also like weirdly, you go with Madness the first time, right?
Yeah, because we had Boyfriends in Madness now. Oh my God.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, we played with Madness, fell in love. I fell in love with the bass player, Mark Bedford, and Jane liked Chrissy and who else? I don't know. And they went back. Because this is when we were like the house band at the Whiskey and the Roxy. They went back and told the Specials. And then the Specials, they loved us. We loved them. So the Specials and Madness talked to our manager, Ginger Canzanieri, about bringing us over. And they were definitely up for it. And we had to figure out how to get the money for flights over there and have the accommodations, everything. So Ginger, God bless her. She She put her car in hock. She like sold all this shit to get enough money to get us all tickets on Freddie Laker Airlines. That was the cheapest airline out there. That play, it, there is no more Freddie Laker. And I remember on that flight, we all sat in the back row. We were smoking and drinking. We were all fucked up. And it was just another, I mean, where we took the party wherever we went. Okay. The party was wherever we went. And then we got over there and we went on a tour with Madness. And then we did some shows in between in London. Then we went out with the Specials, or vice versa. We went out with both bands, like a month with one and then a month with the other. And that was great because we really were living on, we were living on £2.50 a day and living off of like fucking Cadbury bars. And we didn't even have enough money to buy drugs. We used to buy cough syrup and drink. We'd have cough syrup parties.
Well, they got codeine in their cough syrup over there, though.
And beer. We would get, that was it. That was as much as we could do. We were poor. And so it was so great to be on tour with both of those bands because then we could get a meal every day.
I think talking to some other people in the band, they felt like that those tours was a little rough, though, because the audience of those bands were
attractive. Oh, yeah, they hated us. The audience is, here we are thinking we're going to go to England. We are going to be embraced by the UK. They're going to love us. We're so far ahead of anything in the States. And we get over there and they hated our guts. And every night it was, you know, beer bottles whizzing by your head, or Belinda would walk up stage covered in spit. I mean, they did not like us. And the Specials crowd was, they were especially rough on us. Mm. Cause they were like the real hardcore punks. They were part of that National Front. They were like the white supremacists. Bunch of assholes, and it was rough crowds. But we made it through that, and it toughened us up. And when we came back from England, we were ready for anything, man. We were ready to go. Nothing could touch us after that. I mean, at first we'd walk off stage crying, and you know, whoever was in the other band would comfort us, like, "Don't worry, baby, you're gonna be fine." Blah 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 blah. And after a while, we'd walk out on stage. We're like, "Fuck you! What do you got?"
Yeah,
we're ready.
Well, that's something I've heard, and just from doing the show, is that the Specials, like, you know, I guess like the weirdly, like, it seems so disparate, but they would attract a white power Nazi.
Yeah, They were a militant bunch.
Yeah,
that would come to the shows, and they were there really. They were really, really there to incite violence. They just wanted to fight. That's all. I mean, those fucking mosh pits. There was blood, a lot of blood, and a lot of, I mean, there was fights every night. But I think they went there more to do that than even listen to the music.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it definitely feels like that's one of the other sad parts of, like, punk rock, is, like, this other, you know, I guess the flip side of that coin is this free place for art and people to be creative and embracing people. The other flip side is that it's a place with not a lot of rules. And because of that, people sometimes are drawn to it that don't have good intentions, you know.
Absolutely. No, that certainly was the case many, many nights. And it, like I say, mainly the Specials, they're who they attracted was a, you know, pretty violent bunch. But we were just there to play music, you know.
And you wanted doing a record on Stiff, right?
Yeah, we put out We Got the Beat, Dave Robinson, Ginger did it. We did a deal for a single and we put that out on Stiff. And of course, nothing happened for us in the UK. We were a big flop. But in the meantime, that We Got the Beat import on Stiff was happening in the States in clubs. It seemed a lot of DJs were playing We Got the Beat, and it was really starting to get some heat. So we come back here and, you know, everything's happening. We're exploding. We're filling clubs. Lines around the block. We do have to do two or three nights wherever we played. And then it moved up to theaters. You know, it was really starting to happen. And the We Got the Beat single made it so. And then, of course, you know, we got the deal with IRS, and then we were off and running.
It feels like that We Got the Beat single. I love the version of two on We Got the Beat. Single, yeah. It's awesome. And the flip side of How Much More.
How Much More.
Oh, it's so awesome. And it feels like that, you know, coming out, you know, obviously it doesn't make it in England, but like that almost is like a cred thing in America, and having it kind of like
it almost serves you better that it helps build you as an underground band first, like making.
You know what? You're right. You're 100% right. I agree with you. Absolutely. It was way fucking cooler to have to go out and buy that import, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Because I know how I felt when I would go to the record store. I wanted to buy every British import. Mm-hmm. I would immediately run to that section of the record store and see what's new. What's in? What do you got for me? You know? Because I was so into all British music.
Did you see The Damned when they came? Were you still in Baltimore when they came for the first time? Because I know they play L.A.
No, I didn't see them in Baltimore. I saw them out in L.A., I'm sure.
They play, I think, super early on. They're one of the first punk bands, I think, to show up in Los Angeles.
They were great. Oh, they were incredible. Great.
Oh, and never got bad. Like, they never got bad. They all their records are good.
I have a lot. I have several Damned records. I have all my vinyl, man.
That's awesome. You probably have some great stuff.
I do. I have so many great albums. And you know what I would do? I would bring them to different places, like when we're rehearsing, like, and get whoever we're rehearsing with to sign it, like my Black Sabbath records. I got everybody to sign that. And, you know, I don't know. I would bring them wherever I could.
That's awesome. Well, I know, but I think that's what makes your new book so special is because, you know, you're experiencing all these amazing things and achieving all these amazing things, but as a music fan. So,
you know what? And I'm still a huge music fan. I am so excited whenever I meet anybody. And the funny thing is like, it's like now the Go-Go's really are in that group of iconic,
oh, absolutely.
Acts. Yeah. And it's weird because I feel like, who is that imposter? Who is that person in the band? Meaning me, I can't get over our status and like where we are, and this journey has just been, feels like a big dream. You know, it's like because whenever I'm talking to anybody or meeting them, I'm like an excited, like I'll always be that kid from Dundalk. Always, 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 always. That'll never go away.
Well, John Worster, one of my favorite drummers and friend of the show, hit me up and when I told him that you were coming on the show and wanted me to ask, is it true that you were at one point were going to join the Replacements?
No.
Okay, that's not a rumor he had heard.
I follow him. I follow him on Instagram on IG.
A hilarious person. Very, very funny. And another person who loves rock and roll, like as a nerd for it. And like I mean that in the best way possible. But like,
yes, of course. I love that. Yeah. Being a nerd's sexy.
Yeah, exactly. Like who wouldn't want to be a nerd? Like how could you not be passionate about this stuff and obsessed with this stuff?
You know, I don't know. I'm the same way about it, except I've always felt like I was very cool.
Yeah, well, you are. You're a go-go. Like, you know, you set the bar. Well, I think that's the thing is like you talked about, you know, how you guys had to thrift, you know, because you're poor. Like that's your reality is thrifting to get clothes and how that.
Yeah.
But because you did that, that made it cool. So the next generation of kids didn't feel bad about having to thrift. It was cool that you thrifted.
That's, you know, what's funny is like Martha Quinn does a, has a little essay she wrote in my book. Mm-hmm. And I've been talking to her lately and she was like, you know, Gina, when I saw the way you guys dress, she said, I went out to a thrift store and bought stuff so I could dress like you guys.
Yeah.
I was like, if you want to dress like the Go-Go's, just go to a thrift store.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, you know, because a lot of the stuff we're talking about prior to that, like glam and even the stuff that's happening during punk, like rockabilly, like it requires, and even punk requires a lot of investment up front that like not a lot of people had money to do. So to see a band that's going out and just buying stuff on the cheap and styling it that way and making it cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. We were definitely self-styled. It was just, you know, we'd all help each other get outfits and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I just remember Jane and I going on Saturdays, going to the thrift store every Saturday.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that's the thing when it gets to LA, that's where that really comes in. Like that sort of like punk can be anything you want it to be. Cause
yeah,
it's very fashion and New York, even that New York stuff's very fashion early on.
Absolutely. You know, when I came to LA, I just came out as a musician. I didn't care where I fit in. Well, I was gravitated toward the punk scene because that really appealed to me. And the first thing I did when I got in the band is they shaved my head off and dyed my hair black. Boy, did I need a makeover. I came out and had a fucking afro. You know, I hadn't figured out. I had a weird little style of my own, but they definitely helped me get it together. J. Jane especially. She was like, she's mine. I will take care of this one. Let me take care of this one.
Well, you have that. You have that colorful Baltimore vibe, and they needed to colorful flair from Baltimore, and they needed to rein that in a little bit to the LA
Absolutely.
Cool.
Now that I think of it, I should have kept the fro. That would have been really fucking cracked.
Bring it back now. Why not? Gina, this has been amazing. And anytime you want to come back on here and talk about any of this stuff, please know the door is always open.
Oh my God, this has been such a pleasure. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you, Gina, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, Gina will be back for a part two at some point in the future. Because, oh my gosh, that was awesome. That's why we do this thing. Hey, Cam, how great was that? Cam didn't actually hear the episode right now. I'm throwing him off. Okay. I'm sorry, Cam. I don't mean to interrupt. He's somehow downloaded Roblox out of my phone.
No, this was already on.
Oh, it was already on?
Yeah, you remember that time when we played together?
Oh, it's from when we played together. Okay. Well, I'm going to go get him off screens because there's already been a lot of screens today. And that's it for the show this week. Thank you everyone for listening. Next week on the show, this is a fun one, from the band The Asexuals, from the band The Doughboys, from just a legend, like The Asexuals are so underrated, and they're going to be having records reissued coming up, so hopefully that will shed light on the influence of this band, because when you hear that first Asexuals record, oh my gosh, it is mind-blowing how much it kind of set the groundwork for. Anyway, I shouldn't ramble at this point, but John Kastner is going to be on this show. This is a super fun conversation with a guy who, yeah, once again, the Doughboys, they were in a lot of places at a lot of very interesting and key times. And it's a very good conversation. I'm very excited for you to hear it. A very good conversation. That sounds so weird. All right, that's it. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous peoples matter. We need to protect trans kids. We need to help trans people protect themselves and stop hate and violence towards people and just stop all this stuff, because these things that we're talking about here, these are people's fundamental rights and freedoms. You know, this isn't political. This is beyond political. Political is important, but this is beyond political. So get involved in groups and organizations that are doing things that affect change, positive change in the world, or things that you believe in, and lend your support financially, lend your body. If there's safe demonstrations and protests and things you feel safe for yourself to be involved with, and you know, like, just get involved, because that's the best way to try and change the world. Also, this podcast, as always, supports people's reproductive choices and rights to choose what they want to do with the reproductive systems. Systems. Sounds very weird. Let's go out there and try and make this world a little bit better, because we can do it. I know we can. Positive thinking right now, right? Positivity. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they look for those organs, you don't need them anymore. And they could change someone's life, like Uncle Bill, right, Cam? Uncle Bill got a new heart. They gave him a heart transplant.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it changed his life. And so sign your organ donor cards, you know. You can listen to this podcast. If you go back and listen to episodes, you listen to me talking about how people should sign their organ donor cards before he had his heart transplant. And now here we are a few years removed from it. And it's just wild that I'm able to say that now from a place of, like, do this, because it really does change people's lives. People don't need those organs when they're come for them. Go out there and make your own culture. Anyone can do this stuff, Cam. You can start a band. You could DJ. You could create YouTube videos. You know, anyone can do this stuff, Cam. Make a podcast like Daddy does. Takes a lot of time, though. Does the podcast take a lot of time for Daddy to do?
Yeah.
I know. They get very, very frustrated with this.
And go to the washroom.
And I go to the washroom. Okay. And that's it. I think that's it. Get your vaccine. Cam got his vaccine. Hey, buddy?
One.
You got one. The first one. The first one. And are you feeling good? You're feeling okay?
No, it still hurts in my elbow, but it's not.
Your elbow?
Yeah.
Well, that's not where the needle went.
So, I know.
Okay, well, the pain apparently is transferred to the elbow. But I think apart from that, I haven't heard any complaints. And there were no fevers or anything like that.
Yeah,
so.
Because I was talking to Dory about it.
You were? What were you saying to Dory about it?
Talking to Dory about
it. What were you talking to Dory about it?
I'll just tell him. That's all.
That's all. Okay. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. See you on the next episode. John Kastner. It's a good one. Bye.